Side 2. The Shining Ones. The Tomilee, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 44. She smiled faintly.
You're almost too civilized to be a revolutionary, Sarabian. Are you sure you want to overthrow the government?
Good God, Ilana, it's my government, and the power was mine in the first place.
But you didn't use it. You were lazy and self-indulgent, and you let it slip away. Your ministers have filched your authority bit by bit. Now you're going to have to wrest it back from them. People don't willingly give up power, so you'll probably have to kill some of your ministers in order to prove to the rest that you're serious.
Kill!
That's the ultimate expression of power, Sarabian, and your situation here requires a certain ruthlessness. You're going to have to spill some blood in order to get your government's attention.
I don't think I can do that, Sarabian said in a troubled tone. Oh, I know I've blustered and made threats a few times, but I couldn't actually order someone killed.
That's up to you, but you'll lose if you don't. And that means that they'll kill you.
She considered it.
They'll probably kill you anyway, she added, but at least you'll die for something important. Knowing that they're going to kill you in the end might help you make some unpleasant decisions at the outset. Once you get past your first couple of killings, it grows easier. I speak from a certain amount of experience on the subject, since almost exactly the same thing happened to me. Primate Anias completely controlled my government when I came to the throne, and I had to try to take my power back from him.
You're the one who's been talking so freely about killing Ilana. Why didn't you kill Anias?
She laughed a brittle, chilling little laugh. It wasn't because I didn't want to, believe me, but I was too weak. Anias had very carefully stripped the crown of all its authority. I had some help from Lord Vanyan and his Pandian knights, but Anias had control of the army and the church soldiers. I killed a few of his underlings, but I couldn't get to him. He knew I was trying, though, and that's why he poisoned me. Anias was really a very good politician. He knew exactly when the time for killing had arrived.
You sound almost as if you admired him.
I hated him, but he was very good.
Well, I haven't killed anybody yet, so I can still step back from this.
You're wrong there. You've already drawn your dagger, so you're going to have to use it. You crushed that uprising, and you've imprisoned the Minister of the Interior. That's the same thing as a declaration of war.
You did those things, he accused her.
Yes, but I was acting in your behalf.
So it's the same thing,
at least in the eyes of your enemies. You're in danger now, you know. You've let your government know that you're going to seize back the power you let slip away. If you don't start killing people, and soon, you probably won't live out the month. You'd be dead already if you hadn't taken refuge in this castle.
You're starting to frighten me, Ilana.
God knows I've been trying. Like it or not, Sarabian, you're committed now.
She looked around. The sun was sinking into the cloud bank, building up over the mountains lying to the west, and its ruddy glow was reflecting from the mother-of-pearl domes of Mytherian.
Look at your city, Sarabian, she told him, and contemplate the reality of politics. Before you're done, that red splashed all over the domes won't just be the reflection of the sunset.
That's blunt enough, he said, his jaw taking on an unfamiliar set. All right, how many people do I have to kill in order to ensure my own safety?
You don't have that many knives, my friend. Even if you butcher everybody in Mytherian, you'll still be in danger. You might as well accept the fact that you're going to be in danger for the rest of your life.
She smiled at him.
Actually, it's kind of exciting, once you get used to it.
Well, sir, your queenship, Ka'alador drawled. It's all pretty much the way we was a-thankin' it was. That Krager feller, he was a-tellin' old Sporehawk vactual truth. Me and Stragan, we been a-twistin' the arms and a-settin' fire to the feet of them fellers as was picked up durin' the coup.
He stopped.
Would your majesty be too disappointed if I spoke like a human being for a while? That dialect starting to dislocate my jaw.
Not to mention the violence it's doing to the mother tongue, Stragan murmured.
The three of them had gathered together in a small blue-draped room adjoining the royal apartment later that same evening. Ilana and Stragan were still dressed for dinner, she in crimson velvet and he in white satin. Ta'alador wore the sober brown of a businessman. The room had been carefully checked several times to be sure that no hidden listening posts lurked behind the walls, and Mirtai grimly stood watch outside the door. With the exception of Interior Minister Colada, we didn't scoop up anybody of significance, Ta'alador continued, and none of our other prisoners knows very much. I'm afraid we don't have much choice, Your Majesty. We're going to have to work on Colada if we want anything useful. Ilana shook her head. You won't get anything out of him either, Ta'alador. He'll be killed as soon as he opens his mouth.
We don't know that for certain, my queen, Strachan disagreed. It's entirely possible that our subterfuge has worked, you know. I really don't believe that the other side knows that he's a prisoner here. His policemen are still getting their orders from him.
He's too valuable to risk, she said. Once he's been torn to pieces, he'll be very hard to put back together again.
If that's the way you want it, Your Majesty. Ta'alador shrugged. Anyway, it's growing increasingly obvious that this uprising was a pure hoax. Its only purpose was to compel us to reveal our strength. What concerns me the most is the fact that Krager and his friends obviously knew that we were using the criminals of Mytherion as our eyes and ears. I'm sorry, Strachan, but it's the truth.
It was such a good idea, Strachan sighed.
It was at first, but the trouble was that Krager's seen it before.
Talon told me that your friend Platymy used to have whole crowds of beggars, whores, and pickpockets following Krager around. The best idea in the world wears a little thin if you overuse it.
Strachan rose to his feet, muttering curses, and began to pace up and down in the small room with his white satin doublet gleaming in the candlelight.
It looks as if I've failed you, my queen, he admitted. I let a good idea run away with me. You couldn't really trust my judgment after a blunder like that, so I'll make arrangements to go back to Emsat.
Oh, don't be an ass, Strachan, she told him, and do sit down. I can't think while you're clumping around the room like that.
She sure knows how to put a feller in his place, don't she, Strachan?
Ta'alador laughed.
Ilana sat tapping one finger thoughtfully against her chin. First of all, let's keep this in the family. Sarabian's already getting a bit wild-eyed. Politically, he's an infant. I'm trying to raise him as quickly as I can, but I can only move him just so fast. She made a sour face. I have to stop every so often to burp him.
Now that's a picture for you, Ta'alador grinned. What's he choking on, Your Majesty?
Murder, primarily, she shrugged. He doesn't seem to have the stomach for it.
Ta'alador blinked. Not many do.
Politicians can't afford that kind of delicacy. All right, if Krager and his friends know about our spy network, it won't be long until they try something in the way of penetration, will it?
You're quick, he said admiringly.
Quick people live longer. Start thinking, gentlemen. We've got an exploitable situation here, and it won't last for very long. How can we use it to our greatest advantage?
We might be able to identify real conspirators instead of dupes, Your Majesty, Strachan mused. If they do try penetration, they're going to have to subvert some of our people. Let's say that we start passing out assorted fairy tales. This story to some pickpocket, another to some beggar or whore. Then we sit back to see which of those fraudulent schemes the other side attempts to counter. That will identify the turncoats in our own ranks, and we can squeeze useful names out of them.
Surely we can get something a little better than that, she fretted.
We'll work on it, Your Majesty. Ta'alador promised. If it's all right with you, I'd like to follow up on something else as well. We know that Krager's been busy here in Mytherion, but we don't know how much information about our methods he's passed to his friends in other kingdoms. We might as well get what use we can out of our makeshift intelligence service before it becomes totally useless. I'll pass the word to the criminals down in Arjuna. I'd like to find out one way or the other if that silly scholar at the university has blundered across the real truth or if he's just weaving a theory out of moonbeams. I think we might all find a complete biography of the fellow known as Scarpa really fascinating reading. If nothing else, whether or not our spies in Arjuna succeed, will tell us how much Krager really knows about the scope of our operations. If he thinks it's only localized, our apparatus hasn't been too severely compromised.
Go after the others as well, Ilana told him. See what you can find out about Baron Perak, Rebal,
and Saber. Let's try to attach names to Reball and Saber at the very least.
We'll do her just the way your majesty commands.
I'd be happier in a pig in mud if you would, Ka'alador, she replied. Ka'alador collapsed in helpless laughter.
It's probably the change in the weather, your majesty, Aileen said. It's getting chillier at night, and the days aren't nearly as warm as they were just a few weeks ago.
She grew up in Samura, Aileen, Ilana disagreed, and the weather changes there much more markedly than it does here in Mytherian.
It's a different part of the world, though, my queen, Baroness Melodir pointed out. We're right on the seacoast, for one thing. That could be what's causing the problem. Sometimes children react more strongly to things like that than adults.
You're both making too much out of it, Mirtai told them. All she needs is a tonic. She's not really sick. She's just moping around.
But she sleeps all the time, Ilana fretted. She even falls asleep when she's playing.
She's probably growing, the giantess shrugged. I used to do the same sort of thing when I was a little girl. Growing is very hard work, I guess.
The object of their discussions lay drowsing on a divan near the window, with Rollo loosely clasped in her arms. Rollo had survived 2 generations of intense affection. He had been dragged about by one hind leg. He had been laid upon, crammed into tight places, and ignored at times for weeks on end. A shift in his stuffings had given him a slightly worried expression. Queen Ilana viewed that as a bad sign. Rollo had never looked worried when he had been her toy. Myrrh, on the other hand, seemed quite content. An owner who didn't move around very much suited Myrrh right down to the ground. When Princess Danae was dozing, she was not dreaming up ridiculous things to do to her cat. Myrrh secretly felt that any day which did not involve being dressed up in doll's clothing was a good day. She lay on her little mistress' hip, with her front paws sedately folded under her chest, her eyes closed, and a soft, contented purr coming from her throat. So long as nothing disturbed her naps, Myrrh was perfectly at peace with the world. The royal princess Danae dozed, her mind far more involved with the conversation Flute was holding with Sparhawk and his friends on the Isle of Tiga than with her mother's concern over her health here in Mytherian. Danae yawned and nestled down with toy and cat and drifted off to sleep.
Dearest, we've reached Tiga, and we'll be going out into the countryside for a while to see what's afoot. I'll be out of touch for a bit, so I thought it might be a good idea to let you know that we've arrived safely. Don't be too concerned if you don't hear from me for quite some time. I'm not entirely sure how long we'll be submerged in the population here. The others are growing impatient to get started. There's no real point to this letter, except to tell you that I love you. But that's probably the most important point of all, isn't it? Kiss Danae for me. All my love, Sparhawk.
Oh, that's nice, Ilana murmured, lowering the note from her husband. They were all sitting in the blue-draped sitting room in the queen's apartments, and the arrival of Ka'alador with Sparhawk's letter had interrupted a serious discussion about what they were going to do about the interior ministry. Ka'alador, dressed again in sober brown and carrying a grotesque porcelain figurine from 12th-century Arjuna, was frowning.
I think you might want to remind the people at the gates of the compound that they're supposed to let me in, Your Majesty. I had a bit of an argument again.
What's this?
Emperor Sarabian asked.
Master Ka'alador's serving as my procurer of antiquities, Ilana explained. It gives him an excuse to come and go without interference. I've gathered a whole room full of assorted bric-a-brac since I've arrived here.
That brings us right back to the issue we were discussing before you got here, Ka'alador, Stragan said.
Stragan wore black today, and Ilana privately felt that the color didn't really suit him. He rose and began to pace up and down, a habit the Queen of Alenia found irritating.
The Interior Ministry is beginning to flex its muscles for some reason. We're sitting on the minister himself, so this onset of burliness is probably coming from some underling.
Interior has always liked to throw its weight around, Oscania told them.
The foreign minister was wearing Western-style clothes again, and he still looked distinctly uncomfortable in them.
I think that reinforces the point I was trying to make earlier, Ilana, Sarabian said.
Are you sure we shouldn't dissolve the Interior Ministry right now?
Absolutely, Ilana replied. We've got Kolata buttoned up inside the castle here, and we've given the world a perfectly legitimate reason for his presence. He's still functioning, under our control, and that's of enormous value to us. We're playing for time, Sarabian. We're terribly vulnerable until Tinian and Emban come back from Kyrellos with the Church Knights, or at the very least, until all the Aton commanders have been advised that they aren't supposed to obey the orders of the Interior Ministry anymore. We definitely don't want the Aetons fighting on both sides if trouble breaks out.
I hadn't thought of that, he admitted.
Not only that, Your Majesty, Oscania added gently, it's entirely possible that Interior would simply ignore a proclamation disbanding them. They have almost total power, you know. Queen Ilana's right. We can't move against them until we're sure of the Aetons.
Stragan had continued his pacing.
Nobody can subvert an entire branch of government, he declared. There are just too many people involved, and all it would take would be one honest policeman to expose the entire scheme.
There's no such thing as an honest policeman, Stragan, Ka'alador said with a cynical laugh. It's a contradiction in terms.
You know what I mean.
Stragan shrugged that off.
We know that Kolata has dirty hands. But we can't be sure just how far that disloyalty goes. It could be very widespread, or it could be confined to just a few in the higher councils of the ministry.
Ka'alador shook his head.
"'Tain't horridly likely, Stragan,' he disagreed. "'You gotta have them as you can trust out thar when you start giving orders as runs contrary to regular policy. They's gotta be some in the hinterlands as knows what's what.'
Stragan made a face.
I wish you wouldn't use that vile dialect when you're right. It makes me feel inadequate. All right, then. We can be fairly certain that most of the higher-ranking officials in the ministry are involved. But we can't even guess at how widespread the contamination is. I'd say finding that out gets to be a priority.
Shouldn't take you more than a couple hundred years to do that, Stragan,
Ka'alador noted.
Not necessarily,
Baroness Melodir disagreed.
She looked at Oscania. You once said that the Ministry of the Interior is very fond of paper, Your Excellency.
Of course, Baroness. All government agencies adore paper. Paperwork provides full employment for our relatives. Interior goes a little farther, though. Policemen can't function without files and dossiers. They write everything down.
I rather thought that might be the case. The people over at the Interior are all trained as policemen, aren't they?
Oscania nodded.
Then they'd all be compulsive about writing reports and filing them, wouldn't they?
I suppose so, he said.
I don't see where you're going with this exactly, Baroness.
Wake up, Oscania, Sarabian said excitedly. I think this wonderful girl's just solved our problem for us. Someplace over in that rabbit warren at Interior, there's a set of files that contains the names of all the disloyal policemen and secret agents in the Empire. All we have to do is get our hands on that set of files, and we'll know exactly which people to pick up when the time comes to move.
Except for the fact that they'll defend those files to the death, Ilana observed. And there's also the fact that a move against their filing system would be the same as a frontal assault on the ministry itself.
You really know how to burst bubbles, Ilana, the Emperor complained.
There might be a way around the Queen's objections, Your Majesty,
Melodir said with a slight frown.
Is there a standardized filing system here in Mytherium, Minister Oscania?
Good God, no, Baroness, he exclaimed. If we all had the same filing system, anybody at all could walk into our offices and find anything he wanted. We'd never be able to keep any secrets from each other.
I thought that might be the case. Now then, suppose that Queen Ilana happened to mention to the Emperor, just in passing, that her government had standardized the filing system, and that everybody filed things the same way. Then let's suppose that the Emperor grew very excited about the idea, the enormous savings in the cost of government and all that. Then, still supposing, he appoints an imperial commission with extraordinary powers to examine everybody's files with an eye toward that standardization. Wouldn't that justify a search of the offices and interior?
It's got possibilities, my queen, Stragan approved. Something like that would hide what we're really up to. Particularly if we had people tearing up everybody else's files at the same time.
Oscania's face went absolutely white.
"I'd sooner take poison than insult you, little lady," Calidor drawled to the Baroness. "But you're still a-talkin' about a chore, which it is that had taken us a good 20 year or more to finish. We got us a whole buildin' over thar to take aport, if'n the furrin minister year is correct about how many tons of paper they got over to interior."
"We can shorten that a bit, Master Calidor," Melodir replied. "All we have to do is question Interior Minister Colada."
"Absolutely not," Ilana said sharply. "I don't want him all torn to pieces, at least not until I don't need him any more."
"We wouldn't be asking him any sensitive questions, Your Majesty," Melodir said patiently. "All we want to know is how his filing system works. That wouldn't compromise the conspiracy he's involved in, would it?"
"I think she's right, Ilana," Mirtai said. "There would almost have to be some sort of trigger, questions about certain subjects that would make our enemies decide to kill Colada. They wouldn't kill him if all we did was ask him about something as ordinary as a filing system, would they?"
"No," the Queen agreed. "They probably wouldn't at that." Her expression was still dubious, however.
"It's all very clever, Baroness," Stragan said. "But we'll be sending Tamil officials into the various ministries to investigate files. How will we know that at least some of them aren't on the other side?"
"We wouldn't, Milord Stragan. That's why we'll have to send our own people, the Church Knights, in to review those files."
"How would we justify that?"
"The new filing system would be an Aline invention, Milord. We're obviously going to have to send Alines into the various ministries to evaluate the current methods and to instruct the officials on how to convert to the new system."
"Now I've got you, Baroness," he said triumphantly. "This is all a fiction. We don't have a new filing system."
"Then invent one, Milord Stragan," she suggested sweetly. Prime Minister Subot was deeply troubled by the suggestion the Chancellor of the Exchequer had just placed before him. The two were alone together in the Prime Minister's ornate office, a room only slightly less magnificent than one of the Imperial audience chambers.
"You're out of your mind, Gashon," he declared flatly. Chancellor of the Exchequer Gashon was a bloodless, corpse-like man, with sunken cheeks and no more than a few wispy strands of hair protruding from his lumpy scalp.
"Look at it more closely, Pandya Subot," he said in his hollow, rusty-sounding voice. "It's only a theory, but it does explain many things that are otherwise incomprehensible."
"They wouldn't have dared," Subot scoffed.
"Try to lift your mind out of the 14th century, Subot," Gashon snapped. "You're the Prime Minister, not the Keeper of Antiquities. The world is changing all around you. You can't just sit still with your eyes firmly fixed on the past and hope to survive."
"I don't like you very much, Gashon."
"I'm not terribly fond of you either, Subot. Let me go through it for you again. Try to stay awake this time."
"How dare you?"
"I dare, because I'd sort of like to keep my head where it is. First off, the Alines of Eosia are absolute barbarians. Can we agree on that at least?"
"All right."
"They haven't caused much trouble in the past, because they were too busy fighting among themselves about religion, and because they had Otha of Zemok to worry about. Would it surprise you too much if I told you that Otha's dead, and that the Rendorish insurgency's been almost completely crushed?"
"I have my own sources of information, Gashon."
"Have you ever considered listening to what they tell you?"
"Now then, there was open warfare in the streets of Kyrellos preceding the elevation of this Dolmont to the Archprelacy. I'd say that's a fair indication of the fact that he's not universally loved. The best way I know of for a shaky ruler to consolidate his position is to contrive a foreign adventure, and the only real foreign ground for the Alines of the Eosian continent is Deresia, the Tamil Empire. That's us, in case you hadn't noticed, Pandya Subot."
"I know that, Gashon."
"I just wanted to be sure, that's all. Are you with me so far?"
"Get to the point, Gashon.
I don't have all day.
Did you have an appointment with the headsman? All right. The Alenes are religious fanatics who feel that they're called of the Lord to convert everybody in the world to their absurd faith. For all I know, they also want to convert snakes, spiders, and fish. Dulmont's their religious leader, and they'd probably try to subdue glaciers and tides if he told them to. So, we've got a religious leader who has an uncertain grasp on power in his own church, and he has hordes of fanatic followers at his disposal. He can either use those followers to crush his opponents at home, or he can hurl them against a foreign power on some trumped-up excuse that will inflame the commons and stifle objections to his rule. Isn't it a coincidence that at precisely that time we have this state visit by a silly female? A female who Foreign Minister Oscania assures us is the Queen of Alenia. I hope the fact that we have only Oscania's word for that hasn't escaped you. This so-called queen is obviously more accustomed to doing business in bed than she is on a throne. She clearly wrestled that silly ass Alberin of Astel into submission, and probably Androl of the Aetons as well. We can only speculate about her adventures among the Poloi and the Styrix at Sarsos. Then, once she reached Metherion, she lured Emperor Sarabian to her bedchamber before the first day was out. You did know that Sarabian and Oscania crept across the compound to that imitation Aline castle on the first night she was here, didn't you? Subhat started to object. Yes, I know. Gashon cut him off. That brings us to Oscania. I'd say that the evidence strongly suggests that Oscania has gone over to the Alenes, either for personal gain, or because he's fallen under the spell of that blonde Aline's trumpet. She had plenty of time to work on him while he was in Kyrellos, you know. It's all speculation, Gashon, Subhat said, although his voice lacked conviction. Of course it is, Subhat, Gashon replied with heavy sarcasm. What would be the fastest way to get to Metherion from Kyrellos?
By ship, naturally.
Then why did the strumpet of Samura choose to come overland? Was it to look at scenery, or to grapple her way across the continent? The girl's got stamina. I'll give her that.
What about this recent coup attempt, Gashon? The government would have fallen if the Alenes hadn't been there.
Ah, yes, the famous coup. Isn't it astounding that a group of Alenes who didn't even speak the Tamil language when they arrived, were unable to unearth this dire plot in about 6 weeks, when the agents of the Ministry of the Interior, who've only been in Metherion for all of their lives, hadn't come across a single clue about it? The Alenes crushed an imaginary coup, Subhat, and now they've used it as an excuse to imprison the Emperor in that cursed fortress of theirs, and Interior Minister Kolata as well. And Kolata's the one man in government who has the resources to free our ruler. I've talked with Teovin, director of the secret police, and he assures me that no one from the ministry has been permitted to speak with Kolata privately since his incarceration. Our colleague is obviously a prisoner, and the orders he's issuing are just as obviously coming from the Alenes. Then, if that weren't bad enough, they've sent the so-called churchman Emban back to Kyrellos to lead the church knights back here to deal with the crisis. We have all the resources of Interior and whole armies of Aetons at our disposal, Subhat. Why do we need the church knights? What possible reason is there to bring the most ruthless force in the entire world to Tamale? Would the word invasion startle you? That's all that the famous coup really was, you realize. An excuse for the Aline Church to invade Tamale. And quite obviously, it's been with the Emperor's full cooperation.
Why would the Emperor conspire with the Alenes to topple his own government?
I can think of any number of reasons. Maybe this so-called queen threatened to deny him her favors. Most probably, though, she's been spinning fairy tales for him, telling him about the joys of absolute power. That's a common fiction in Eosia, Eline rulers like to pretend that they're the ones who make all the decisions in their kingdoms, rather than permitting the government to do it for them. We both know how ridiculous that idea is. A king, or in our case, the emperor, only has one function. He's a symbol of government, nothing more. He serves as a focus for the love and loyalty of the people. The imperial government's been engaged in a selective breeding program for the past 1,000 years. The emperor's Tamil wife, the one who produces the heir to the throne, is always selected for her stupidity. We don't need intelligent emperors, only docile ones. Somehow, Sarabian slipped past us. If you'd ever really taken the trouble to pay attention to him, you'd have discovered that he's frighteningly intelligent. Golata blundered there. Sarabian should have been killed long before he ascended to the throne. Our revered emperor is beginning to hunger for real power, I'm afraid. Normally, we could deal with that. But we can't get at him to kill him as long as he's inside that blasted fortress.
You weave a convincing story, Gishon, the Prime Minister conceded with a troubled frown. I knew it was a blunder to invite that Sparhawk savage to come to Mithilien.
We all did, Supat. And you'll recall who it was who overrode all our objections?
Oskania, Subat spat.
Precisely. Is it beginning to fit together for you now?
Did you devise all of this by yourself, Gishon? It's a little elaborate for a man who spends all his time counting pennies.
Actually, it was Teoven, the director of the secret police, who brought it to my attention. He provided me with very concrete evidence. I've summarized it for you here. Interior has spies everywhere, you know.
Nothing happens in the Empire that doesn't generate a report for those famous files of theirs.
Now, Pandya Subat, what does our esteemed Prime Minister propose to do about the fact that our Emperor is being held prisoner, willingly or unwillingly, not 100 paces from where we sit? You're the titular head of government, Subat. You're the one who has to make these decisions. Oh, and while you're at it, you might want to give some thought to how we're going to prevent the Church Knights from sweeping across the continent, marching into Mithilien, and forcing everyone to bow down to their ridiculous god, and butchering the entire government in the process.
They're trying to stall, Your Majesties, Strachan reported. When supper time comes, they escort us to the door, push us outside, and lock the door behind us. The building stays locked for the rest of the night, although there are always plenty of lights moving around in there after dark. When we go back the next morning, everything's been rearranged. The files migrate from room to room like ducks in the autumn. I wouldn't actually swear to it, but I think they move walls as well. We found a room just this morning that I don't think was there last night.
I'll send in Ngesses Etons, Sarabian said darkly. We'll chase everybody out, and then tear the building apart brick by brick. No, Ilana said, shaking her head. If we make an overt move against Interior, every policeman in the Empire will scurry down a rabbit hole.
She pursed her lips.
Let's start to do inconvenient things to the other ministries as well. Don't make it obvious that we're concentrating all of our attention on the Ministry of the Interior.
How can you possibly make things any worse than they already are, Your Majesty?
Oskania asked in a broken voice. You've disrupted centuries of work as it is.
Can anyone think of anything? Sarabian asked, looking around.
May I speak, Your Majesty? Aileen asked in a small, timid-sounding voice. Of course, dear, Ilana smiled. I hope you'll forgive my presumption, Aileen apologized. I can't even read, so I don't really know what files are. But aren't we sort of letting on that we're rearranging them?
That's what we're telling everybody, Mirtai replied.
As I said, I can't read, but I do know a bit about rearranging cupboards and such things. This is a little like that, isn't it?
Close enough, Strachan replied.
Well then, when you're rearranging a cupboard, you take everything out and spread it on the floor. Then you put all the things you want in the top drawer in one pile, the things you want in the second drawer in another, and so on. Couldn't we do that with these files?
It's a nice idea, little Dorlin, Cahalador drawled, but they ain't enough floors in the whole building for spreading out all them there files.
There are lots of lawns around the outside, though, aren't there? Aileen kept her eyes downcast as she spoke. Couldn't we just take all the files from every government building outside and spread them around on the lawns? We could tell the people who work in the buildings that we want to sort through them and put them in the proper order. They couldn't really object, and you can't lock the door to a lawn at night or move things around when there are 7-foot-tall Etons standing guard over them. I know I'm just a silly servant girl, but that's the way I'd do it.
Oscania was staring at her in absolute horror. Chapter 4. The soil on the western side of the Isle of Tiga was thin and rocky, and since there was plenty of fertile ground farther inland, the citizens of the Republic had made no effort to cultivate the area. Tough, scrubby bushes rustled stiffly in the onshore breeze as Sparhawk and his friends rode along a rocky trail leading to the coast.
"The breeze helps," Talon observed gratefully. "At least it blows away that stink."
"You complain too much," Flute told him.
The little girl rode with Sophronia, as she had since they had first encountered her. She nestled in her older sister's arms, with her dark eyes brooding. She straightened suddenly, as the sound of surf pounding on the western shore of the isle reached them.
"This is far enough for right now, gentlemen," she told them. "Let's have some supper and wait for it to get dark." "Is that a good idea?"
Bevia asked her.
"The ground's been getting rougher the farther west we come, and the sound of that surf seems to have rocks mixed up in it. This might not be a good place to be blundering around in the dark."
"I can lead you safely to the beach, Bevier," she told him. "I don't want you gentlemen to get too good a look at our ship. There are certain ideas involved in her construction that you don't need to know. That's one of the promises I had to make during those negotiations I was telling you about."
She pointed to the lee side of a rocky hillock.
"Let's go over there out of this wind and build a fire. I have some instructions for you."
They rode away from the ill-defined trail and dismounted in the shelter of the hill. "Whose turn is it to do the cooking?" Barrett asked Sir Olaf.
"Yours," Olaf told him, with no hint of a smile.
"You knew he was going to do that, Barrett," Talon said. "What you just did was almost the same thing as volunteering."
Barrett shrugged.
"My turn will come up eventually anyway," he said. "I thought I'd get it out of the way for a while."
"All right, gentlemen," Vanyan said. "Let's look around and see what we can find in the way of firewood."
Sparhawk concealed a smile. Vanyan could maintain that he was no longer the preceptor as much as he wished, but the habit of command was deeply ingrained in him. They built a fire, and Barrett stirred up an acceptable stew. After supper, they sat by the fire, watching as evening slowly settled in.
"Now then," Flute said to them, "we're going to ride down to a cove. I want you to all stay close behind me, because it's going to be very foggy."
"It's a perfectly clear evening, Flute," Calton objected.
"It won't be when we reach the cove," she told him. "I'm going to make sure that you don't get too much chance to examine that ship. I'm not really supposed to do this, so don't get me in trouble."
She looked sternly at Khalad.
"And I want you, in particular, to keep a very tight rein on your curiosity."
"Me?"
"Yes, you. You're too practical and too clever by half for my comfort. Your noble friends here aren't imaginative enough to make any educated guesses about the ship. You're a different matter. Don't be digging at the decks with your knife, and don't try to sneak off to examine things. I don't want to drop by Simura someday and find a duplicate of the ship anchored in the river. We'll go down to the cove, board the ship, and go directly below. You will not go up on deck until we get to where we're going. A certain part of the ship has been set aside for us, and we'll all stay there for the duration of the voyage. I want your word on that, gentlemen."
Sparhawk could see some differences between Flute and Danae. Flute was more authoritarian, for one thing, and she didn't seem to have Danae's whimsical sense of humor. Although the child goddess had a definite personality, Each of her incarnations seemed to have its own idiosyncrasies. Flute looked up at the slowly darkening sky.
"We'll wait another hour," she decided. "The crew of the ship has been told to stay away from us. Our meals will be put just outside the door, and we won't see the ones who put them there. It won't do you any good to try to catch her, so don't even try."
"Her?"
Ulof exclaimed.
"Are you trying to say that there are women in the crew?"
"They're all females. There aren't very many males where they come from."
"Women aren't strong enough to raise and lower the sails," he objected.
"These females are 10 times stronger than you are, Ulof, and it wouldn't matter anyway, because the ship doesn't have sails. Please stop asking questions, gentlemen. Oh, one other thing. There will be a sort of humming sound when we get underway. It's normal, so don't let it alarm you."
"How?"
Ulof began. She held up her hand.
"No more questions, Ulof," she told him quite firmly. "You don't need to know the answers. The ship's here to take us from one place to another in a hurry. That's all you need to know."
"That brings us to something we really should know," Sparhawk said. "Where are we going?"
"To Jorsen, on the west coast of Edom," she replied. "Well, almost, anyway. There's a long gulf leading inland to Jorsen. We'll put ashore at the mouth of the gulf and go inland on horseback. Now, why don't we talk about something else?"
The fog almost seemed thick enough to walk on, and the knights were obliged to blindly follow the misty light of the torch Sophronia held aloft as they rowed down a steep bank toward the sound of unseen surf. They reached a sandy beach and groped their way down toward the water. Then they saw other lights out in the fog, filmy, mist-shrouded lights that stretched out for what seemed an impossible distance. The lights did not flicker, and they were the wrong color for torchlight.
"Good God!" Ulof choked. "No ship could be that big."
"Ulof!"
Flute said sharply from out of the fog ahead.
"Sorry," he mumbled.
When they reached the water's edge, all they could see was a dark, looming shape lying low in the water several yards out, a shape outlined by those unwinking white lights. A ramp reached from the ship to the beach, and Kyle, Sophronia's white palfrey, stepped confidently onto that ramp and clattered across to the ship. There were dim, shrouded shapes on the deck, cloaked and hooded figures that were all no more than shoulder high, but strangely squat and blocky.
"What do we do with the horses?"
Vanyan asked as they all dismounted.
"Just leave them here," Flute replied. "They'll be taken care of. Let's go below. We can't start until everybody's off the deck."
"The crew stays up here, don't they?" Ulof asked her.
"No, it's too dangerous."
They went to a rectangular hatchway in the deck and followed an inclined ramp leading down.
"Stairs would take up less space," Khalad said critically.
"The crew couldn't use stairs, Khalad," Flute told him. "They don't have legs."
He stared at her in horror.
"I told you that they're not human."
She shrugged. The companionway they reached at the bottom of the ramp was low, and the knights had to half-stoop as they followed the child goddess aft. The area below decks was illuminated by pale, glowing spots of light recessed into the ceiling and covered by what appeared to be glass. The light was steady, unwinking, and it definitely did not come from any kind of fire. The quarters to which their little guide led them were more conventionally illuminated by candles, however, and the ceilings were high enough for the tall knights to stand erect. No sooner had Ulof closed the heavy door to what was in effect to be their prison for the next 5 days than a low-pitched humming sound began to vibrate the deck beneath their feet, and they could feel the bow of the strange vessel start to swing ponderously about to point at the open sea. Then the ship surged forward.
"What's making it move?" Carlton asked. "There's no wind."
"Carlton,"
Afriel said sharply.
"Sorry," he muttered.
"There are 4 compartments here," she told them. "We'll eat in this one, and we can spread out and sleep in the other 3. Put away your belongings, gentlemen. Then you might as well go to bed. Nothing's going to happen for 5 days.
Sparhawk and Carlton went into one of the cabins, taking Talon with them. Talon was carrying Halad's saddlebags as well as his own.
"What's your brother up to?"
Sparhawk asked the boy suspiciously.
"He wants to look around a bit," Talon replied.
"Afriel told him not to do that."
"So?"
They were all staggered a bit as the ship gave another forward surge. The humming sound climbed to a whine, and the ship seemed to rise up in the water, almost like a sitting man rising to his feet. Colton threw his saddlebags onto one of the bunks and sat down beside them.
"I don't understand any of this," he grumbled.
"You aren't supposed to," Sparhawk replied.
"I wonder if they've got anything to drink aboard. I could definitely use a drink about now."
"I wouldn't get my hopes up too high. And I'm not sure you'd care to drink something brewed by non-humans. It might do some strange things to you."
Khalad came into the tiny compartment, his eyes baffled.
"I don't want to alarm you, gentlemen," he said, "but we're moving faster than a horse can run."
"How do you know that?" Talon asked him.
"Those curtains in that central cabin are hanging over openings that are sort of like portals. They've got glass over them anyway. I looked out. There's still fog all around us, but I could see the water. We passed a floating log, and it went by like a crossbow bolt. There's something else, too. The hull curves back under us, and it isn't touching the water at all."
"We're flying?"
Colton asked incredulously.
Khalad shook his head.
"I think the keel's touching the water, but that's about all."
"I really don't want to know about this," Colton said plaintively.
"He's right, Khalad," Sparhawk said. "I think this is one of the things Afriel told us was none of our business. Leave those curtains closed from now on."
"Aren't you the least bit curious, my lord?"
"I can live with it." "You don't mind if I speculate just a bit, do you, Sparhawk?"
"Go right ahead, but keep your speculations to yourself."
He sat down on his bunk and began to pull off his boots.
"I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm going to follow orders and go to bed. This is a good chance to catch up on our sleep, and we've all been running a little short on that for quite some time now. We'll want to be alert when we get to Jorsen."
"Which only happens to be about a quarter of the way around the world," Khalad added moodily, "and which we're going to reach in just 5 days. I don't think I'm put together right for this kind of thing. Do I have to be a Pandian knight, Sparhawk?"
"Yes," Sparhawk told him, dropping his boots on the deck. "Was there anything else you wanted to know before I go to sleep?"
They all slept a great deal during the next 5 days. Sparhawk strongly suspected that Afriel might have had a hand in that, since sleeping people don't wander around making discoveries. Their meals were served on strange oblong trays that were made of some substance none of them could identify. The food consisted entirely of uncooked vegetables, and they were given only water to drink. Colton complained about the food at every meal, but since there was nothing else available, he ate it anyway. On the afternoon before they were scheduled to arrive, they gathered together in the cramped central compartment.
"Are you sure?" Colton dubiously asked Flute when she told them that they were no more than 10 hours from their destination.
She sighed.
"Yes, Colton, I'm sure."
"How do you know? You haven't been up on deck, and you haven't talked to any of the sailors. We could have been..."
His words sort of faded off. She was looking at him with a long-suffering expression as he floundered on.
"Oh," he said then. "I wasn't thinking, I guess. Sorry."
"I do love you, Colton, in spite of everything."
Khalad cleared his throat.
"Didn't Dolmont tell you that the Edomish have some strong feelings about the church?"
he asked Sparhawk. Sparhawk nodded.
"As I understand it, they look at our Holy Mother in almost the same way that the Rendors do."
"Church knights wouldn't really be welcome then, I gather."
"Hardly."
"We'll need to disguise ourselves as ordinary travelers then."
"More than likely,"
Sparhawk agreed. Vanyan had been looking at his map.
"Exactly where are we going from Jorsen, Afriel?"
he asked Flute.
Up the coast a ways,
she replied vaguely.
That's not very specific.
Yes, I know.
He sighed.
Is there any real need for us to go on up the Gulf of Jorsan to the city itself? If we were to land on the north shore of the Gulf, we could avoid the city entirely. Since the Edomish have these prejudices, shouldn't we stay away from them as much as possible?
We have to go to Jorsan, she told him.
Well,
she amended,
Jorsan itself isn't that important, but we're going to see something along the way that will be.
Oh, what's that?
I have no idea.
You get used to that, Sparhawk told his friend. Our little goddess here gets hunches from time to time. No details at all, just hunches.
What time will we make our landfall?
Ulaf asked.
About midnight, she replied.
Landing on a strange shore at night can be a little tricky, he said dubiously.
There won't be any problems. She said it with absolute confidence.
I'm not supposed to worry about it. Is that it?
You can worry if you want to, Ulaf.
She smiled.
It's not necessary, but you can worry all you like if it makes you feel better.
It was foggy when they came up on deck again, a dense, obscuring fog, and this time the strange ship showed no lights. Their horses, already saddled, were waiting, and they led them down the ramp to a pebbly beach. When they looked back out toward the water, their ship was gone.
Where did she go?
Ulaf exclaimed.
She's still there,
Afriel smiled.
Why can't I see her, then?
Because I don't want people to see her. We passed a number of ordinary ships on our way here. If anybody'd seen her, there'd be wild talk in every sailor's tavern and every port in the world.
It's all in the shape of the keel, isn't it?
Khalad mused.
Khalad, she said sharply, you stop that immediately.
I'm not going to do anything about it, Flute. I couldn't if I wanted to. But it's that keel that accounts for her speed. I'm only mentioning it so that you won't make the mistake of thinking I'm so stupid that I can't put it together.
She glared at him. He bent slightly and kissed her cheek.
That's all right, Flute, he smiled. I love you anyway, even if you do underestimate me at times.
He's going to work out just fine, Dalton said to Vanyan.
The hillside rising from the gravel strand was covered with thick, rank grass, and by the time they had reached the top of the hill, the fog had entirely dissipated. A broad highway of reflected moonlight stretched out across the calm waters of the gulf.
My map shows a kind of track a mile or so inland, Vanyan told them. It seems to run up the gulf in the general direction of Jorsan.
He looked at Flute, who was still glaring darkly at Khalad.
Pending instructions to the contrary from higher authority, I suppose we can follow that track.
He looked inquiringly at the child goddess again. She sank a little lower in Safrinia's arms and began to suck her thumb.
You'll make your teeth crooked.
She pulled her thumb out of her mouth and stuck her tongue out at him.
Shall we press on, then?
Vanyan suggested. They rode on across a broad, rolling meadow, covered with the rank salt grass. The moon washed out all color, making the grass whipping at the horse's legs seem gray, and the forest beyond the meadow a formless black blot. They rode slowly, their eyes and ears alert, and their hands never far from their sword hilts. Nothing untoward had happened yet, but these were trained knights, and for them the world was always filled with danger. After they rode in under the trees, Vanyan called a halt.
Why are we stopping?
Flute demanded a little crossly.
The moon's very bright tonight, Vanyan explained, and our eyes need a little time to adjust to the shadows here under the trees. We don't want to blunder into anything.
Oh.
Her night isn't going too well, is it? Barrett murmured to Sparhawk. She seems to be very upset with Khalad.
It's good for her. She gets overconfident sometimes, and a little too much impressed with her own cleverness.
I heard that, Sparhawk,
Flute snapped.
I rather thought you might have, he replied blandly.
Why is everyone mistreating me tonight? She complained.
They're only teasing you, Afriel, Safrinia assured the little girl. Clumsily, of course, But they're Alleans, after all, so you can't really expect too much from them.
Shall we move on before things start to turn ugly? Vanyan said.
They rode at a walk through the shadows, and after about half an hour they reached a narrow, rutted track. They turned eastward and moved on, riding a little faster now. How far is it to Jorson, my lord? Bevier asked Vanyan after they had gone a ways.
About 50 leagues, Vanyan replied.
A goodly ways, then. Bevier looked inquiringly at Flute. What? She said crossly. Nothing, really. Say it, Bevier. I wouldn't offend you for the world, Divine Afriel. But could you speed the journey the way you did when we were traveling across Deira with King Wargan's army? No, I can't. You've forgotten that we're waiting for something important to happen, Bevier, and I'm not going to fly past it just because you're in a hurry to get to the taverns of Jorson. That will do, Sophronia told her.
Since it was still early autumn, they had not brought tents with them, and after about another hour's travel, they rode back into the forest and spread their blankets on beds of fallen leaves to get a few hours' sleep. The sun was well up when they set out again, and they traveled through the forest until late afternoon without encountering any local people. Once again they moved back into the forest about a quarter of a mile and set up for the night in a narrow ravine where an overhanging bank and the thick foliage would conceal the light from their small cooking fire. Rather surprisingly, Ulaf did the cooking without any of his usual subterfuge.
"It's not as much fun when Tinian isn't along," he explained.
"I miss him too," Sparhawk agreed. "It seems strange to be traveling without all those suggestions of his." "This cooking business has come up before," Vanyan observed. "Am I missing something?"
"Sir Ulaf normally keeps track of it, my lord," Talon replied. "It's a very complicated system, so none of the rest of us really understands how it works."
"Wouldn't a simple roster do just as well?" Vanyan asked.
"I'm sure it would, but Sir Ulaf prefers his own method. It has a few drawbacks, though. Once Calton cooked every single meal for an entire week."
Vanyan shuddered. They had smoked mutton chops that evening, and Ulaf received some hard looks from his companions about that. Flute and Sophronia, however, complimented him on his choice. After they had eaten, they sought their makeshift beds. It must have been well past midnight when Talon shook Sparhawk awake, laying a cautious hand across his mouth to prevent his crying out.
"There are some people back near the road," the boy whispered. "They've built a big fire."
"What are they doing?" Sparhawk asked.
"Just standing around waiting for somebody, it seems. Unless you want to count the drinking."
"You'd better rouse the others," Sparhawk told him, throwing off his blankets and reaching for his sword.
They crept through the forest in the darkness and stopped at the edge of a stump-dotted clearing. There was a large bonfire in the center of the clearing, and nearly 100 men, peasants for the most part, judging from their clothing, sitting on the ground near the blaze. Their faces were ruddy from the reflected light and from the contents of the earthenware jars they were passing around.
"Strange place to be holding a drinking party," Ulaf murmured. "I wouldn't come out this far into the woods for something as ordinary as that."
"Is this it?" Vanyan asked Flute,
who was nestled in Sophronia's arms, concealed by her sister's dark cloak.
"Is this what?"
"You know what I mean. Is this what we are supposed to see?"
"I think so," she replied. "I'll know better when they all get here."
"Are there more coming?"
She nodded.
"One, at least. The ones who are already here don't matter."
They waited as the peasants in the clearing grew progressively more and more rowdy. Then a lone horseman appeared at the far edge of the clearing, near the road. The newcomer wore a dark cloak and a slouch hat pulled low over his face.
"Not again," Talon groaned. "Doesn't anybody on this continent have any imagination?" "What's this?" Vanyan asked.
"The one they call Saber up in Astel wore the same kind of clothes, my lord."
"Maybe this one's different. I wouldn't get my hopes up too high."
The man on horseback rode into the firelight, dismounted, and pushed back his hat. He was a tall, gangly man, with a long, pockmarked face and narrow eyes. He stepped up onto a tree stump and stood waiting for the peasants to gather around him.
Hear me, my friends, he said in a loud, harsh voice. I bring news.
The half-drunk babble of the peasants faded.
Much has happened since last we met, the speaker continued. You will recall that we had determined to make one last try to resolve our differences with the Tamils by peaceful means.
What choice did we have, Ribal? One of the peasants shouted. Only madmen would attack the Aetime garrison, no matter how just their cause.
So that's Ribal, Colton whispered. Not very impressive, is he? Our cause was made just by Incites himself, Ribal was responding. And Incites is more than a match for the Aetons.
The mob murmured its agreement.
There is good news, my friends, Ribal declared. Our emissaries have been successful. The Emperor himself has seen the justice of our cause.
A ragged cheer went up.
I rejoice even as you, Ribal continued. But a new peril, far more grave than the simple injustice of the corrupt Tamil administrators, has arisen. The Emperor, who is now our friend, has been taken prisoner by the accursed church knights. The evil arch-prelate of the Church of Kyrellos has reached halfway around the world to seize our friend.
Outrageous! A burly peasant in the crowd roared. Monstrous!
The rest of the peasants looked a bit confused, however. He's going too fast, Talon whispered critically. What? Barrett asked. He's changing course on them, Talon explained. I'd guess that he's been cursing the Tamils for the last year or so, the same way Saber was, up in Astal. Now he wants to curse somebody else, but he's got to uncurse the Tamils first. Even a drunken peasant's going to have some suspicions about the miraculous conversion of the Emperor. He made it all too fast, and too easy.
Tell us, Ribal, the burly peasant shouted. How was our friend the Emperor taken prisoner?
Yes, tell us.
Another man on the far side of the crowd howled. Planted henchman, Talon sneered. This Ribal's about as subtle as a club in the face.
It was clever, my friends, Ribal declared to the crowd. Very clever. The Church of Kyrellos is guided by the demons of hell, and they are the masters of deceit. The Tamils, who are now our friends, are heathens, and they do not understand the guile of the heretics of Kyrellos. All unsuspecting, they welcomed a delegation of church officials, and among those foul heretics who journeyed to Mithurian were knights of the church, the armored minions of hell itself. Once in Mithurian, they seized our dear friend and protector, Emperor Sarabian, and they now hold him prisoner in his own palace. Death to the Tamils, a wheezy-voiced old man, far gone in drink, bawled.
One of the other peasants rapped him sharply across the back of the head with a cudgel, and the slightly out-of-date demonstrator sagged limply to the ground. Crowd control, Talon sniffed. Ribal doesn't want people making any mistakes here. Other peasants, obviously more of Ribal's planted henchmen, began to shout the correct slogan.
Death to the church knights!
They brandished crude weapons and assorted agricultural implements as they bellowed, emphasizing their slogan and intimidating the still confused.
The purpose of these monsters is all too clear, Ribal shouted over the tumult. It is their plan to hold the Emperor as hostage, to prevent the Aetons from storming the palace. They will sit safe where they are until reinforcements arrive, and make no mistake, my friends, those reinforcements are even now gathering on the plains of Eosia. The armies of the heretics are on the march, and in the van come the church knights.
Horrified gasps ran through the ranks of the peasants.
On to Mithurian, the fellow with the cudgel bellowed. Free the Emperor!
The crowd took up the shout. Ribal held up one hand.
My blood burns as hotly as yours, my friends, he shouted. But will we leave our homes and families to the mercies of the knights of the church? All of Eosia marches toward Mithurian. And what stands between accursed Eosia and fire-domed Mithurian? Edom, my friends! Our beloved homeland stands in the path of the heretic horde. What mercy can we expect from these savages? Who will defend our women from foul rape if we rush to the Emperor's aid?
Cries of chagrin ran through the crowd. Ribal moved quickly at that point,
And yet, my friends, he rushed on, our defense of our beloved homes may yet aid our friend the Emperor. The beasts of Eosia come to destroy our faith and to slaughter the true believers. I know not what course you may take, but I pledge to you all that I will lay down my life for our beloved homeland and our holy faith. But in my dying, I will delay the church nights. That spawn of hell must pause to spill my blood, and their delay will give the Aetons the time to rally. Thus may we defend our homes and aid our friend in one stroke.
Sparhawk began to swear, half strangling to keep his voice down.
What's your problem? Carlton asked.
We've just been blocked. If those idiots out there accept what Rebal's telling them, the church knights are going to have to fight their way to Mytherian foot by foot.
They're very quick to exploit a changing situation, Benyon agreed. Too quick, perhaps. It's almost 1,000 leagues from here to Mytherian. Either someone has a very good horse, or our mysterious friend out there is breaking the rules again in order to get word out to the hinterlands of what happened after the coup was put down.
Rebal was holding up his hands to quiet the shouting of the crowd.
Are you with me, my brothers? He called. Will we defend our homes and our faith and help our friends the Tamils at the same time?
The mob howled its assent.
Let's ask Incites to help us, the man with the cudgel shouted. Incites! Another bellowed. Incites! Call forth Incites!
Are you sure, my friends?
Rebal asked, drawing himself up and pulling his dark cloak tightly around him.
Call him forth, Rebal. Raise Incites. Let him tell us what to do.
Rebal struck an exaggerated pose and raised both arms over his head. He began to speak, intoning guttural words in a hollow, booming voice.
Is that Styric? Carlton whispered to Sophronia. It doesn't sound like Styric to me.
It's gibberish,
she replied scornfully. Carlton frowned.
I don't think I've ever heard of them, he whispered. What part of the world do the gibbers come from?
She stared at him, her face baffled.
Did I say it wrong? He asked. Are they called the Gibberese? Or maybe the Gibberinians? The people who speak gibberish, I mean.
Oh, Carlton, she laughed softly. I love you.
What did I say?
Rebal's voice had risen to a near shriek, and he brought both arms down sharply. There was a sudden explosion in the middle of the bonfire, and a great cloud of smoke boiled out into the clearing.
Hearken, masters all, a huge voice came out of the smoke. Now hath the time for where he come. Now be me troth, shall all true Edomishmen on live to arms. Take ye up the iron sword. Gird ye your limbs all in the iron hauberkian and the iron helm. Smite ye the fiends foul, which beasts derk do set home and fay in deadly peril. Go ye to battle fierce, to fend the fiends of the accursed church of Kyrellos. Follow, follow! Follow me as goddess Hondus yeave ye force.
Old Hyalenic, Bevier exclaimed. Nobody's spoken that tongue in thousands of years.
I'd follow him, whatever tongue it is, Uloth rumbled. He makes a good speech.
The smoke began to thin, and a huge ox-shouldered man wearing ancient armor and holding a mighty two-handed sword above his head appeared at Rebal's side.
Havoc!
He bellowed.
Havoc and where?
Chapter 5 They've all gone now, Barrett reported when he and Talon returned to the camp, concealed in the narrow ravine. They spent a lot of time marching around in circles, shouting slogans first, though. Then the beer ran out, Talon added dryly, and the party broke up. He looked at Flute. Are you sure this was supposed to be important? He asked her. It was the most contrived hoax I've ever seen. She nodded stubbornly.
It was important, she insisted. I don't know why, but it was.
How did they make that big flash and all the smoke? Carlton asked. One of the fellows near the fire threw a handful of some kind of powder onto the coals,
Khalad shrugged. Everybody else was watching Rebal, so they didn't see him when he did it.
Where did the one in the armor come from?
Ulaf asked. He was hiding in the crowd, Talon explained. The whole thing was at about the same level as you'd find at a country fair, one that's held a long way from the nearest town.
The one who was pretending to be in Cetes gave a fairly stirring speech, though, Ulaf noted.
It certainly should have been, Bevier smiled. It was written by Phalactes in the 7th century.
Who was he? Talon asked.
Phalactes was the greatest playwright of antiquity. That stirring speech came directly from one of his tragedies, Etonicus. That fellow in the antique armor substituted a few words is all. The play's a classic. It's still performed at universities once in a while.
You're a whole library all by yourself, Bevier, Colton told him. Do you remember every single thing you've ever read, word for word?
Bevier laughed. I wish I could, my friend. Some of my classmates and I put on a performance of Etonicus when I was a student. I played the lead, so I had to memorize that speech. The poetry of Phalactes is really very stirring. He was a great artist. Archean, naturally. I never liked him very much, Flute sniffed. He was as ugly as sin. He smelled like an open cesspool, and he was a howling bigot.
Bevier swallowed hard.
Please don't do that, Afriel, he said. It's very unsettling.
What was the story about? Talon asked, his eyes suddenly eager.
Etonicus was supposed to be the ruler of a mythic kingdom somewhere in what's now eastern Camoria,
Bevier replied.
The legend has it that he went to war with the Styrix over religion.
What happened?
Talon's tone was almost hungry. He came to a bad end, Bevier shrugged. It's a tragedy, after all. But...
You can read it for yourself sometime, Talon, Vanyan said firmly. This isn't the story hour.
Talon's face grew sulky.
I'd be willing to wager that you could paralyze our young friend here in mid-theft,
Ulaf chuckled.
All you'd have to do is say, once upon a time, and he'd stop dead in his tracks.
This throws a whole new light on what's been happening here in Tamale,
Vanyan mused.
Could all this be some vast hoax?
He looked inquiringly at Flute. She shook her head.
No, Vanyan, there has been magic of varying levels in some of the things we've encountered.
Some, perhaps, but not all, certainly. Was there any magic at all involved in what we saw tonight?
Not a drop.
Is that how you measure magic? Colton asked. Curiously. Does it come by the gallon?
Like cheap wine, you mean?
She suggested tartly.
Well, not exactly, but... This was very important, Sparhawk said. Thank you, Afriel.
I live but to serve.
She smiled mockingly at him.
Stop that.
You've missed me entirely, Sparhawk, Colton said.
We've just found out that not everything that's being reported back to Mytherian is the result of real magic. There's a fair amount of fraud mixed in as well. What does that suggest?
The other side's lazy.
Colton shrugged.
I'm not so sure, Ulaf disagreed. They're not afraid to exert themselves when it's important.
2, Sophrenia said. 3 at the most.
I beg your pardon,
Ulaf said with a puzzled look.
Now do you see how exasperating that is, Ulaf?
She said to him.
This charade we watched here tonight rather strongly hints that there aren't many people on the other side who can really work spells. They're spread out a bit thin, I'd say. What's going on here in Edom, and probably in Astel and Deconia as well, is rather commonplace, so they don't feel they have to waste magic on it.
Commonplace or not, it's going to seriously hinder Tinian when he tries to lead the church knights across Daresia to Mytherian, Sparhawk said. If Rebal can stir up the whole kingdom the way he did this group tonight, Tinian's going to have to wade his way through hordes of howling fanatics. The Edomish peasantry is going to be convinced that our brothers are coming here to impose heresies on them by force, and they'll be lurking behind every bush with sickles and pitchforks.
We still have a certain advantage, though, Bevier said thoughtfully. There's no way that our enemies can possibly know that we're here in Edom, and that we saw this business tonight. Even if they were to know that we're going to raise Belium, which isn't very likely,
they wouldn't know where it is. So they'd have no idea where we were going. Even we don't know where we're going.
And even if they did, they wouldn't know that we could get here as quickly as we did,
Khalad added.
I think we've got the jump on them, my lords. If they're relying on hoaxes here, that probably means that they don't have any magicians around to sniff us out. If we can pass ourselves off as ordinary travelers, we should be able to move around without much hindrance and pick up all sorts of information in the process.
We're here to retrieve the Bellium, Khalad, Flute reminded him.
Of course, but there's no point in passing up little treasures as we go along, is there?
Afriel, Vanyan said,
have we seen and heard everything we were supposed to?
She nodded.
I think we might want to move on to Jorsen rather quickly, then. If Khalad's right, and we're one jump ahead, let's stay that way. What would it take in the way of bribes to persuade you to speed up the journey?
We could negotiate that, I suppose, Lord Vanyan. She smiled. I'm sure you could all offer me something that might induce me to lend a hand. They kissed the child goddess into submission and arrived in Jorsen late the following day. Jorsen turned out to be a typical Aline port city, squatting at the head of the gulf. The question of suitable disguises had arisen during the journey. Bevier had leaned strongly in the direction of posing as religious pilgrims. Calton had liked the notion of masquerading as a group of rowdies in search of constructive debauchery, while Talon, perhaps influenced by Rebal's recent performance, had thought it might be fun to pose as traveling players. They were still arguing about it when Jorsen came into view.
"Isn't all this a waste of time?" Ulof asked them. "Why should we play dress-up? It's not really anybody's business who we are, is it? As long as we're not wearing armor, the people in Jorsen won't know or care about us. Why go to all the trouble of lying about it?"
"We'll need to wear our mail shirts, Sir Ulof," Barrett reminded him. "How do we explain that?"
"We don't. Lots of people wear chain mail and carry weapons. So it's not really that unusual. If somebody in town gets too curious about who we are and where we're going, I can make him get uncurious in fairly short order."
He held up his hand and closed his fist suggestively.
"You mean just bully our way through?" Calton asked. "Why not? Isn't that what we're trained for?"
The inn was not particularly elegant, but it was clean and not so near the waterfront that the streets around it were filled with brawling sailors lurching from alehouse to alehouse. The sleeping rooms were upstairs over the common room on the main floor, and the stables were in the back.
"Let me handle this," Ulof muttered to Sparhawk as they approached the innkeeper,
a tousled fellow with a long pointed nose.
"Feel free," Sparhawk replied. "You,"
Ulof said abruptly to the innkeeper.
"We need 5 rooms for the night, fodder for 10 horses, and some decent food."
"I can provide all those, good master," the innkeeper assured him.
"Good. How much?"
The man with a pointed nose rubbed at his chin, carefully appraising the big Felician's clothes and general appearance. "That would be a 1/2 crown, good master," he said somewhat tentatively. His rates seemed to be based on a sliding scale of some sort. Ulof turned on his heel.
"Let's go," he said shortly to Sparhawk.
"What was I thinking of?" the innkeeper said, slapping his forehead. "That was 5 rooms and fodder for 10 horses, wasn't it? I got the numbers turned around in my head. I thought you wanted 10 rooms for some reason. A 1/2 crown would be far too much for only 5 rooms. The right price would be 2 silver imperials, of course."
"I'm glad you got your mathematics straightened out," Ulof grunted. "Let's look at the rooms."
"Of course, good master." The innkeeper scurried on up the stairs ahead of them.
"You don't leave very many conversational openings, do you, my friend?" Sparhawk chuckled. "I've never found innkeepers very interesting to talk with."
They reached an upper hallway, and Ulof looked into one of the rooms.
"Check it for bugs," he told Sparhawk.
"Good master," the innkeeper protested.
"I like to sleep alone," Ulof told him. "Bugs crowd me, and they're always restless at night."
The innkeeper laughed a bit weakly. "That's very funny, good master. I'll have to remember it. Where is it you come from, and where are you bound? Olaf gave him a long, icy stare, his blue eyes as chill as a northern winter, and his shoulders swelling ominously as he bunched them under his tunic.
No matter, I suppose, the innkeeper rushed on. It's not really any of my affair, is it?
You've got that part right, Olaf said.
He looked around.
Good enough, he said. We'll stay.
He nudged Sparhawk with his elbow.
Pay him, he said,
turned, and clumped down the stairs. They handed their horses over to the grooms, and carried their saddlebags up to the sleeping rooms. Then they went back downstairs for supper. Colton, as usual, heaped his plate with steaming beef. Maybe we should send out for another cow, Barrett joked.
He's young, Colton told the others jovially, but I like the way he thinks.
He grinned at Barrett, but then the grin slowly faded, and the big blonde Pandian grew quite pale. He stared at the young knight's face for quite some time. Then he abruptly pushed his plate back and rose to his feet.
I don't think I'm really hungry, he said. I'm tired. I'm going to bed.
He turned, quickly crossed the common room to the stairs, and went up them two at a time.
What's the matter with him? Olaf asked in a puzzled tone. I've never seen him walk away from supper like that before.
That's God's own truth,
Bevier agreed.
You'd better have a talk with him when you go up, Sparhawk, Vanyan suggested. Find out if he's sick or something. Colton never leaves anything on his plate.
Or anybody else's, for that matter, Talon added. Sparhawk did not linger over supper. He ate quickly, said good night to the others, and went upstairs to have a talk with his friend. He found Colton sitting on the edge of his bed with his face in his hands.
What's the matter? Sparhawk asked him. Aren't you feeling well?
Colton turned his face away.
Leave me alone, he said hoarsely. Not very likely. What's wrong? It doesn't matter.
The blonde knight sniffed loudly and wiped at his eyes with the back of his hand.
Let's go get drunk. Not until you tell me what's bothering you, we won't.
Colton sniffed again and set his jaw.
It's something foolish. You'd laugh at me. You know better than that. There's a girl, Sparhawk, and she loves somebody else. Are you satisfied now?
Why didn't you say something earlier?
I just now found out about it. Colton, you're not making any sense at all. One girl's always been the same as another to you. Most of the time you can't even remember their names. This time's different. Can we go get drunk now? How do you know she doesn't feel the same way about you?
Sparhawk knew who the girl was, and he was quite certain that she did, in fact, return his friend's feelings for her. Colton sighed.
God knows that there are people in this world who are brighter than I am, Sparhawk. It's taken me all this time to put it together. I'll tell you one thing, though. If he breaks her heart, I'll kill him, brother or no.
Will you at least try to make some sense?
She told me that she loved somebody else, as plain as if she'd come right out and said it in so many words.
Aileen wouldn't do that.
How did you know it was Aileen?
The big blonde man sprang to his feet.
Have you all been laughing at me behind my back? He demanded pugnaciously. Don't be an ass. We wouldn't do that. We've all been through exactly the same thing. You didn't invent love, you know.
Everybody knows, though, don't they?
No, I'm probably the only one, except for Melodir. Nothing much gets past her. Now what's all this nonsense about Aileen loving somebody else?
I just put it together myself.
What did you put together? Try to make a little sense, Colton.
Didn't you hear her singing on the day we left?
Of course I did. She has a beautiful voice.
I'm not talking about her voice. I'm talking about the song she was singing. It was My Bonny Blue-Eyed Boy.
So?
It's Barrett, Sparhawk. She's in love with Barrett.
What are you talking about?
I just noticed it when we sat down to supper. Colton buried his face in his hands again. I never paid any attention before. But when I looked into his face while we were talking, I saw it.
I'm surprised you haven't seen it yourself.
Seen what?
Barrett's got blue eyes.
Sparhawk stared at him. Then, being careful not to laugh, he said,
So do you, when they're not bloodshot.
Colton shook his head stubbornly.
His are bluer than mine. I know it's him. I just know it. God's punishing me for some of the things I've done in the past. He made me fall in love with a girl who loves somebody else. Well, I hope he's satisfied. If he wants to make me suffer, he's doing a good job of it.
Will you be serious?
Barrett's younger than I am, Sparhawk, and God knows he's better looking. Colton, look at the way every girl who gets to within 100 yards of him starts to follow him around like a puppy. Even the Eitan girls were all falling in love with him. Colton, I know it's him, I just know it. God's twisting his knife in my heart. He's gone and made the one girl I'll ever feel this way about fall in love with one of my brother knights.
Colton.
Colton sat up and squared his shoulders.
All right, then, he said weakly. If that's the way God wants it, that's the way it's going to be. If Barrett and Aileen really, really love each other, I won't stand in their way. I'll bite my tongue and keep my mouth shut. Colton.
But I swear it to you, Sparhawk, the blonde Pandian said hotly.
If he hurts her, I'll kill him.
Colton!
Sparhawk shouted at him.
What?
Sparhawk sighed.
Why don't we go out and get drunk? He suggested, giving up entirely.
It was cloudy the following morning. It was a low, dirty gray cloud cover that seethed and tattered in the stiff wind aloft. It was one of those peculiar days when the murk raced overhead, streaming in off the gulf line to the west, but the air at the surface was dead calm. They set out early and clattered along the narrow, cobbled streets where sleepy-eyed shopkeepers were opening their shutters and setting out their wares. They passed through the city gates and took the road that followed the north coast of the gulf. After they had gone a mile or so, Vanyan leaned over in his saddle.
"How far do we have to go?"
he asked Flute, who nestled, as always, in her sister's arms. "What difference does it make?" the child goddess shrugged.
"I'd like to know how long it's going to take."
"What does how far have to do with how long?"
"They're the same thing, Afriel. Time and distance mean the same thing when you're traveling."
"Not if you know what you're doing, they don't." Sparhawk had always admired Vanyan, but never quite so much as in that moment. The silvery-bearded preceptor did not even raise his voice.
"All I'm really getting at, Divine One, is that nobody knows we're here. Shouldn't we keep it that way? I don't mind a good fight now and then, but would bashing our way through crowds of drunken Edomish peasants serve any real purpose right now?"
"You always take so long to get to the point, Vanyan," she said. "Why didn't you just come right out and tell me to speed things up?"
"I was trying to be polite. I think we'll all feel much better about this when Sparhawk's got Bellium in his hands again. It's up to you, though. If you want the road from here to wherever it is you've got Bellium hidden, awash with blood and littered with corpses, we'll be happy to oblige you."
"He's hateful," Afriel said to her sister.
"Oh, I wouldn't say that."
"You wouldn't. Sometimes you two are worse than Sparhawk and Aelana."
End of Side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.